Sai Ram, and welcome dear listeners to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, as always, coming to you live from our studios in Radio Sai. And Radio Sai Answering Booth is a program that we, me and you listeners, do together, don't we? So why not we begin by collectively offering our humble pranams at Swami's lotus feet. After a short break to our question and answers, I'm back this week with a question, dear listeners. And this week's question, though about a specific problem, is going to elicit a general response, which I believe will be useful for all of us on the spiritual path. But we will come to that when we come to that. For now, it's time for me to read for you a quote that caught my attention. Now, this is a quote from one of the best-selling novels of all times. And I'm sure there must be a few of you who have read this novel, or at least have seen the film adaptation of it. The writer is J.R.R. Tolkien, and the novel is The Lord of the Rings. The lines I'm going to read out are actually from a poem that appears in the novel a couple of times. If you're wondering why am I quoting from novels, when I read these lines, you will realize how profound they are. I quote, "Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that's broken. The crownless again shall be king." End of quote. Those lines are very simple, but there are some really profound thoughts in them, don't you agree? Not all those who wander are lost. When I read this line, I'm reminded of Gautama Buddha. He had no clue where he was going, what he was looking for. He left his palace and princely life, but had no clue where he is going and where it is going to lead him to. Would you call him lost? Well, sometimes we look at a worldly person and say, he or she is lost in the pleasures of life. Such people may be quite clear in their head that life is all about enjoyment, but still we say that they are lost in the pleasures of life. So not all who are sure are really sure, and not all who are confused and wandering are really lost. That confusion is actually the first sign that you are no more lost. The next two lines are, "The old that is strong does not wither, deep roots are not reached by the frost." Many times during Swami's discourses, Swami would say, all that I'm telling you is not new. This is the most ancient of all wisdom. Not everything that is old needs to be discarded. In fact, the old, the ancient, and the time-tested is what forms what we call roots. And the deeper these roots, less vulnerable they are to the frost. There may be periods of barren winter, but these roots have a deep existence and can produce life when the time comes. And the last few lines are, "From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king." You know, when we look at ourselves, we look at what we are and we feel pity, fear, diffidence, hesitation, because all of that comes from what we look at ourselves to be. We feel limited, in other words. But when Swami looks at us, Swami sees the potential within. Swami sees the seed of divinity buried deep within, waiting to spring to life. And that is why Swami's words are always filled with hope. We see the dull ash on the outside. Swami sees the hidden embers under it. We believe we are the body, so we see the mrinmaya or the ephemeral. But Swami sees and identifies us with the chinmaya or the eternal. So when we start seeing ourselves from that point of view, we can be sure it's just a matter of time. And for the divine, time just does not matter. So before we get to the question for this week, dear listeners, let me read for you those lines of Tolkien one more time. "Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king." All right then, let's head to the question of this week. The question is from Sister Praveena Kilpadi. I'm hoping I'm getting the pronunciation right. And she's from Delhi. I'll read out the question before I venture to answer it for all of you. Sairam, I attend a study class where we read different Vedantic texts. Though I am a Sai devotee, the others are not. I find I draw a lot from Swami's teachings and can understand and explain many concepts to others. However, the other day, one of the ladies in the class asked the following question. She said she is unable to relate to her past. She cannot relate to the child she had been or the adolescent, the older person she had been a few years back. It is like she is a totally different person today. And she also wonders about her future and karmic consequences for actions done today. If she feels she might not be able to relate to her future self too. Is there something more serious going on here? Or is she just confused because she has changed as a person and is not in touch with her true self? Is there no sync between her thoughts and her actions? On the surface, she seems a very calm, logical, and balanced person. But sometimes, her statements are very ambiguous. She says she has not had a sound grounding in spiritual matters. As a child growing up, her parents at most prayed on occasions like Krishna Janmashtami and other important festivals. She has deep faith in the scriptures and believes in karma and destiny. Reading Vedanta can be jolting if you're not firmly rooted in your belief system. It deals with Brahman, isn't it? And many abstract concepts. Please explain what is going on with her as I am unable to understand her question. Hope you will be able to address this query. Thank you, Praveena Kilpadi, New Delhi. Well, what I read out is actually an abstract of the many exchanges I had with Ms. Praveena over the email. Well, the question itself, as I said, is a bit ambiguous, and I had even mentioned this to the questioner that it's always easier if the person who is really having the question, you know, voices the question to us, another person talking about it, usually leaves a lot of gaps unfilled. And it's difficult to address the question completely. But nevertheless, as always, we'll pray to Swami and answer and hope that we're addressing the right issue. This problem of not being able to relate to your younger self. Now, I wouldn't say that it's very common or it's very natural. But truly speaking, I've come across a couple of people who have had the same problem, who said that they almost have no memories of what they were or what their ideas were when they were children, or even when they were an adolescent. And this has happened to a couple of people. As I said, a couple of people I have met have mentioned this. But they didn't speak of it as an issue, but as a passing comment that this was something which is happening with them. There are many reasons why this could be happening. One is possibly there could have been an unpleasant event in the past, which sometimes the mind tries to forget, and over a period of time, you know, you completely detach yourself from that individual who's had a troubled past. Well, if that is the case, without knowing about it, it's very difficult for me to talk about it. I would suggest that you sit with that person and probably encourage that person to open up and try to share if there's any traumatic events in the past. Well, that will have to be dealt with according to what the problem is. So I wouldn't go into that, but I will talk about some other reasons why this could happen. And one thing is, you know, when we are brought up in a certain manner and when we are exposed to some spiritual learning or spiritual texts, our understanding changes drastically. You know, our belief systems are undergoing a very drastic change. And I've seen this happening with a few people who in or Swami's devotees, because there is a very, very fast shift. In fact, I remember one person who was telling me that their ideas were changing so fast. Every day it was a new understanding, and of course they were growing spiritually, that's what they felt. And they said the growth was so fast that they were able to understand and grasp things so fast, so differently from the way they'd seen it in their childhood or even in their early adult life, that they were literally scared. It was almost like a roller coaster ride that you're speeding. You're happy that you're moving fast, but at the same time, there's a little bit of the adrenaline rush. Though this person, as you say, is not a Swami's devotee, this can also happen when you read about Vedanta or Advaita, or for that matter, any very, very esoteric text which speaks of a very evolved state of truth. In fact, there is a very beautiful episode in the Ramayana where this event which happens in a spiritual aspirant's life is captured through one episode. For those of you who are not aware of this perspective of looking at the Ramayana, one way of looking at the Ramayana and reading it through is that of looking at Rama as an aspirant. Of course, this is a little different from the way you generally look at Ramayana, where you look at Rama as the avatar who's come to vanquish evil forces headed by Ravana. But there is a different approach to it where you look at Rama as, that's why the term which we use sometimes for Rama is Atma Rama. You talk of him as an individual soul which goes through this process of learning and acquiring wisdom. And they say that Mother Sita stands for the mind filled with that Atma Gnan. Right? So his whole journey is from being this lost individual to finding that Atma Gnan, then of course losing it midway, then again gaining it back. There is a certain merit in looking at the Ramayana this way. And when you look at it this way, there is this episode which is very telling. Rama and his brothers have completed their studentship in the Gurukula of sage Vasishtha. They come back and they're youngsters. I think they must have been in their teenage. So they ask their father that they wish to go around the kingdom like a tour. They want to go and see the different places because they're the young prince. They're going to be rulers in the future. So Lord Rama and his brothers, Lakshmana, Bharata, Shatrughna, they expressed this desire to King Dashrata that they would like to go around the kingdom and look at the various places. So Dashrata appoints a minister who takes them around, and Lord Rama is particularly interested in visiting some of the pilgrim centers in the kingdom. So they go to the various places along the Ghats of Ganga, the different holy places in the kingdom. And during this visit, the story goes that Valmiki writes that Rama spends a lot of time with sages and saints and renunciants in these places. He gets into lengthy discussions about spirituality and eventually explores the concept of Vedanta and Advaita philosophy. And the story goes that after this period, suddenly Rama loses interest in everything, right? Because you are suddenly told that there is, you know, you're not the body, you're divine, and everything around you is divine. It says, whatever is seen by the eye is divine. There is no difference between young and old and man and woman and all of that. So he comes back. Here is this prince who comes back from the store, and who was a very obedient young student who is no more able to find the necessity to respect elders, who is not finding a need for luxuries, and they say that he does not derive any happiness from the sports or from eating good food or living a comfortable life. And even when asked questions, he doesn't find the need to answer, because suddenly you've been infused with this wisdom which is so very profound and which talks about a very high state of equality, and you are not able to come to terms with the day-to-day realities of you being a prince, somebody being a minister, someone being a guard, somebody being your mother, someone being your father, and your younger brothers having to respect you, you having to respect the elders. So this is a period which Lord Rama is set to go through, and this has been particularly put in the Ramayana because we as aspirants should realize that this is a very common thing which happens to all of us when we first get exposed to this idea of Advaita. One thing is just listening to it. You know, we've heard it from Swami's discourses many times, but there will be a point when you suddenly start relating to it. You suddenly feel that, yes, this is what it is. And at that time, it really unsettles you. And that's why the episode is there, that Dashrata starts panicking looking at Rama this way. So he sends word to sage Vasishtha Vasishtha comes and looks at Rama and he realizes that this is the face that Rama is acting out in this drama of Ramayana. So there is that episode where Vasishtha explains to Rama about the understanding of spirituality and how it percolates down to everyday life. And that's what is captured in the book called Yoga Vasishtha, which is supposed to be a brilliant text where through different stories and analogies, Vasishtha explains to Rama how you bridge this gap between this duality and the multiplicity that you see in the physical world with this transcendental truth that everything is one, right? So that is one of the episodes which have been placed in the Ramayana to tell us that as spiritual aspirants, this is something which does happen to us. And why does it happen like that? You know, when you talk about the truth of the Brahman, you know, you talk of Advaita, you talk of the Atma Jnan, what they say, the knowledge of the Atma. The Vedas describe it in one verse, which says, in one sentence, which says, Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha. They say that this knowledge, this truth, is in such a place where the mind and words, in their attempt to reach, return defeated. No, that's the meaning of that beautiful phrase, Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha. It resides in that place where the mind and speech return defeated, unable to reach. Now you are taking such a transcendental truth and you're giving it to the mind and you are asking the mind to comprehend it. And an analogy which I always like giving is, you know, here is an object which you say that, let's say it's a slide of a bacteria and that is labeled as invisible to the naked eye. So when you label it as invisible to the naked eye, that becomes a quality of that object that you are showing to a person. You are saying that this cannot be seen with the naked eye, which means that you cannot see it, right? So similarly, here is this transcendental truth, which is given to you with this condition that the mind cannot comprehend it, and you're giving it to the mind. So certainly the mind cannot comprehend it, and there is going to be a lot of confusion in that. And what happens when, you know, when the mind is given something like this, is that the mind gets to very, very simple conclusions, right? Just like how I spoke about what happened with Lord Rama. You come to simple conclusions with this idea that everybody is equal, right? You ask, what is the need for me to respect elders? Especially with youngsters, this happens. When you start exploring Advaita, I think if youngsters are listening to this, you should be very careful of this, because automatically this idea of, you know, if I'm not the body, why should I care for the body? If I'm not the body, why should I care for the age of the body? Why should I respect elders? Why should I respect parents? Right? And what is the sanctity of having only one partner in life? After all, you're not the body. All of these confusions come because you are giving the mind, which is not ready, which is not prepared for this transcendental truth, right? This is because the nature of the mind is Dvaita. The nature of the mind is Maya. Now, what is the purpose of the mind? The mind has been given to you to coast through this life, choosing what you want to do, what you don't want to do, what you like, what you don't like, what you find is acceptable to you, what you find is repulsive to you. The mind is constantly doing this very act. So the mind's nature is duality. The mind's nature is to separate one from the other. And to this dual-natured mind, you are giving a non-dual concept, right? The second reason is, we all are in a level right now, I mean, I can say this with a little bit of generalization, including myself. We all are in the level where we are below the mind and the senses. In the sense, the mind chooses purely on the basis of what the senses like and dislike, right? You eat, you sleep, whatever you choose to do in life. All the time, the senses are guiding the mind. And the mind chooses what to do based on what the senses like and dislike. And the intellect or the intelligence is used to fulfill this journey of the mind and the senses, right? This is the state we are in. So we are under the influence of the mind and the senses. When that is the case, when you give it this transcendental truth that everything is one, there is no good and bad, there's no right and wrong, you're not the body, and you know, you're not going to be touched by the sins of the body. When such a truth is given, it is true in the transcendental level, but when this is given to the mind tends to use it in this very same process I spoke about, where the senses lead the mind and the mind leads the intelligence. So when this truth of non-duality is given to the mind, which is under the influence of the senses, then the mind uses whatever comes its way to further enjoy the journey which it is already in. Right? So that is why what Swami says is the first step before you embark on this quest for the ultimate, the quest for the Brahman, is the mind takes control over the senses, right? The mind is not led by the senses, the mind takes control over the senses, and the intellect, or what you call buddhi, takes control over the mind. So the intellect decides what is good and wrong, and then directs the mind as to what needs to be done, and the mind uses the senses in this journey. So this is the process which needs to be taken, which needs to be embarked upon before you start exploring the concept of Advaita or Vedanta. And since none of us are actually have completed this journey, we are bound to undergo a certain amount of confusion or disorientation when we accept this concept of Advaita. And that is why many, many people, and I repeat it again, especially youngsters, it is the truth. Non-duality is the truth. Because as Swami has himself said many times, the truth is there is no two, but there is only one. Ekam Sat Advitiyam Brahma. That's what they say, right? There is no second. But this truth, your mind or our mind is not prepared for this truth already, right? But when it is given, you will come to very simple conclusions. You will come to very simple expressions of this. And that is why, you know, you appear a bit confused when you start using this Advaitic concept in day-to-day life. I'd like to draw your attention to one of Swami's writings. In fact, it's a commentary on one of the oldest scripts of Vedanta philosophy, which is called Brahma Sutras, right? Brahma Sutras are basically a collection of aphorisms which explain the concept of Vedanta. And in Swami's Vahini, called Sutra Vahini, Swami speaks about the Brahma Sutras. Right? The first aphorism or the first statement of the Brahma Sutra is a very interesting beginning for a text. Imagine a text begins with Athato Brahma Jignasa. Right? Brahma Jignasa means the quest for Brahman. Jignasa means, you know, you having a quest. Brahma Jignasa means having the quest for the ultimate truth. So Athato means hereafter the quest for truth begins. Athato, hereafter, Brahma Jignasa, the quest for truth begins. So Swami and many commentators, even before that, draw our attention to this first aphorism of the Brahma Sutras and say that here is a text which begins with this line saying that hereafter the quest for Brahman will start. So Swami asks, after what? So which means, even to embark on this journey of trying to explore truth, you need a certain amount of preparation. And that's what the Brahma Sutras say, that after this, you can embark on this journey. And there are four prerequisite qualifications, which Swami speaks about. In fact, I spoke about the Yoga Vasishta. The Yoga Vasishta also speaks about these four qualifications. Adi Shankara has spoken extensively about these four qualifications. And pretty much it sums up all of that what we need to prepare our minds with before we are ready to embark on the journey of trying to explore Brahman, right? And these four qualifications are Viveka, Vairagya, Shat Sampatti, and Mumukshatva. I'll give you the meanings of those four qualifications. Viveka is discrimination. Vairagya is detachment. Shat Sampatti is the six virtues. We'll come to them because they're very, very important. And Mumukshatvam is the desire for moksha. Before I come to Viveka, Vairagya and Mumukshatvam, I'd like to speak about Shat Sampatti, because this is a very, very important concept, and especially for the question which we are dealing with and this kind of confusion which comes with studying Vedanta. And not necessarily Vedanta, I think all of us who are even wishing to take Swami's words seriously. Because when you take a Swami's discourse, the Swami's discourse has all of it. It starts with Advaita, then it goes on to Karma, then it talks about the importance of Dharma, then Swami speaks about devotion. So when we take Swami seriously, when we read Swami's discourse, these are actually in different levels of understanding. So we would, in our devotion, want to grasp all of it, and that will definitely lead to a certain amount of confusion. And that's why this concept of Shat Sampatti, which Swami has so very beautifully written about in Sutra Vahini, if any of you have the opportunity, you should go and read that, because it very clearly says what are the things we need to do to prepare this mind. The Shat Sampatti, the first two are called Shama and Dhamma, right? Where Shama means mind control and Dhamma is body and sense control. The Shama and Dhamma are very, very important, where, you know, you're talking about a truth which is beyond the mind and the body, which is beyond the physical. But to understand that, the first step is control of the body and the senses and the mind, right? And when you talk about control of the mind, Swami says the ability to first of all concentrate, to focus on something. When you do something, to be able to do it with all your mind and all your concentration. That's why Swami says that, I mean, it's not any rocket science. What do you need to do to achieve this mind control? Simple things like meditation, japa, bhajans, namasmarana. All of these help in one, first of all, purifying the mind, and secondly, helping the mind focus. Because, as I said, the hierarchy of control is the intelligence or the intellect or the buddhi decides what needs to be done, and the mind and the senses follow suit, right? So when you choose to do something, when you decide that I would like to do this on this particular day, you should be able to have control over your mind to enable you to do that, right? That's the first and foremost thing to do. So the first step is to have a certain amount of mind control, a certain amount of calmness in the mind. And Swami says that this can be done, achieved through meditation, namasmarana, bhajans and all of that. And that is why, especially people, devotees of Swami, I see this. It doesn't mean that once you turn to the Advaitic knowledge, these things become irrelevant. It doesn't mean that japa, dhyana and all of that becomes irrelevant, because all of this are in simple ways prerequisites for you to focus on the higher truth. Coming to the concept of sense control, and Swami says that it's very simple. What the easiest thing, way to achieve that is you're prioritizing what you're supposed to do at any given time. And that can be done by leading a dutiful life, right? Swami says the practice of swadharma, or when you are a householder, sticking to the dharma of an householder. If you're at your work, doing what your work demands. If you're a citizen on the road, being conscious of your responsibilities as a citizen on the road. All of this is, in a way, you're controlling your senses, you're controlling your faculties. You don't let them go astray, because These are the pattern of behavior that I have to follow given my stage in life. In that way, I mean, one thing is you're creating a harmonious society, you're creating a harmonious home, but as an individual, you are actually holding back the reins of these horses, which are the senses. And that's how you gain sense control. And that's how Swami says, Sama and Dhamma, which are very, very central. In fact, I think 3 or 4 days back, we sent out a Science Spires message where Swami says this. All spiritual quest begins with Shama or mind control and Dhamma, sense control. So all of these things which we do, bhajans, namasmarana, meditation, doing your duty as a householder, as an officer, as a son, as a daughter, all of that leads to this Shama and Dhamma, which are very, very important. And Swami also adds doing seva also leads to sense and mind control, because it not only helps you control, take control of these faculties, but it also purifies these faculties. Those are the first two of the Shat Sampatis, Shama and Dama. The third one is Uparati. Uparati means withdrawal from sensual pleasures. Again, if you look at it, it's actually an extension of Samaya and Dhamma, where it means at any given time you would like to do something, you would like to indulge in some form of sensual pleasure, but you hold back yourself because that is not what you're supposed to do then. And you can do that when you master this quality of Uparati, where you have complete control over your senses. It does not mean that you don't indulge at all. And this is one thing which Swami would often point out. The sages of the past, be it sage Vasishtha, Vishwamitra, or, you know, many of these sages whom we talk about in our scriptures, all of them were actually leading married lives. And Swami would say, it's not that they completely did not indulge in a worldly life, but they knew exactly when to indulge and how much to indulge. And that is because they had completely withdrawn, they had mastered this quality of Uparati, and they could employ this need whenever there was a necessity. And that is the stage which Swami says about Uparati. And this can be done when you use your discrimination constantly. You don't let your senses decide what you do, but you decide what you do and you use your senses for that purpose. The next comes Titiksha. Titiksha is the quality of forbearance and forgiveness, and I think many times I've had questions about this on the show. This is a very, very important quality which prepares your mind for this higher quest. Your ability to forgive people, your ability to say that I will not let my actions be driven by hatred and revenge. I will not let these qualities decide what I'm supposed to do, but I will decide what I'm supposed to do. And the ability to accept whatever good and bad happens in life as part and parcel of the journey. That is Titiksha. And then Swami speaks about Shraddha or faith, which again is a very important quality. And this is not about just faith in God or faith in Swami. It's about faith in the path itself. It's about faith in the truth itself. Right? Because when you want to stick to the spiritual path, Swami says that there will be a plenty of temptations on the path. You might have a neighbor who's having a very, very worldly life and being very successful at that. And that's a temptation. You will stop and ask this question, why at all should I follow a spiritual path when I'm not enjoying and so-and-so seems to be having a ball of a time? And Swami says at that time that Shraddha, the ability to see beyond what is there happening right around you and sticking to the faith. And then Swami speaks about the quality of Samadhana, which again is a necessity even for faith, where you're able to look at life equal-mindedly. You're not looking at life as, you know, so-and-so is a worker, so-and-so is a minister, and favors start coming. You treat people differently because you feel that somebody is greater, somebody is lesser. And that is the sixth quality. So the six qualities or the six virtues which Swami says are very, very important are Sama, Dama, Uparati, Titiksha, Shraddha and Samadhana. Now coming to the other three qualities, because I said Shat Sampati is only one of four, and the other are Viveka, Vairagya and Mumukshatva. Now interestingly, all these three qualities are actually the nature of our mind. Viveka means discrimination, and the word Viveka actually means to separate one from the other. And as I said, that's what the mind does all the time, right? But when you have purified your mind through these six virtues, this Viveka becomes spiritual discrimination. And Swami says you start discriminating between what is real and what is unreal, what is true and what is untrue, Atma and Anatma. And that is what happens to this mind, which is always discriminating between what I like and dislike, to this discrimination of what is real and what is unreal. And then comes Vairagya. Vairagya is nothing but in day-to-day life, we see this as prioritization, right? I would like to do something, but in the time probably I might spend in a party, if I can work overtime at work, I can earn some more money. So you give up one pleasure for another form of purpose, right? And this is what vairagya is. But when your mind is purified through these processes, your mind starts giving up everything that is worldly and focuses on that which is real. So that vairagya becomes spontaneous, and from the day-to-day prioritization, your mind starts doing this higher form of vairagya, where the lower pleasures in life, the lower ambitions don't excite you anymore. And finally, the concept of mumukshatvam. Again, the mind is always seeking for something which is more eternal. Yes, we go after joys, but we also at the same time look for security. We look for joy which is long-lasting. Why do we look for a career? Why do we look for a job which gives us job security? Because we not only want happiness, but we want the happiness to last. And this same quality of the mind, when the mind is purified, it turns to the most eternal form of joy. And that is when it starts searching for moksha or mumukshatvam. And this is what Swami says in the Sutra Vahini. But does that mean that only when we have crossed all of these stages, only when we have complete control over our mind and senses, that we can turn to Brahma Jignasa or the quest for Brahman? There's a very, very beautiful analogy. I think I'll try to wind up as soon as possible, where Swami speaks about the same concept of Brahma Jignasa and a very, very beautiful and succinct analogy. Swami says, you know, you want to make coconut chutney, right? So what do you do when you want to do coconut chutney? You go around, collect the ingredients, get the coconut, get the salt, get the spices. Then you start preparing this coconut chutney, right? Swami says that this act of procuring the ingredients is karma jignasa, the action that needs to be performed. And this act of preparing the groundnut chutney, you have to, there's a certain process that you follow, right? In this act of preparation, putting together these raw ingredients to form this coconut chutney, Swami says, is dharma jignasa, the process of dharma, the quest of dharma, right? And finally, after you prepare the coconut chutney, Swami says, you take one piece of it, one spoon of it, and you put it in your tongue to taste if the coconut chutney is tasting well. And this act of tasting, Swami says, is Brahma Jignasa. Why is this analogy very important? Swami says, when you taste that coconut chutney, you will realize that either the salt is more or salt is less, it's too spicy. And depending on your judgment of how the coconut chutney is tasting, now you go back to that same process. If you need more salt, you get more salt, or you add more spice to the chutney. Again, it is karma jignasa and dharma jignasa. Or if you find the whole chutney has been messed up, you start the process all over again. So Swami says that when you take to the quest of Brahman, when you take to the quest of Advaitic wisdom, life will throw challenges at you where it will test all of these qualities that I spoke about. Viveka, Vairagya, Titiksha, Sama, Dama, and all of this. Life will start testing this, Titiksha, your forbearance, your Samadhana. And this test actually gives you an opportunity to look at yourself and say that, all right, I'm still not prepared yet. So you go back to that cycle of karma and dharma. Do more actions, do more dharmic actions. Review yourself. Where am I lacking? What am I doing wrong? So this is a process. It's not necessarily chronological. You don't, start checking these boxes and finally go to Brahma Jignasa. Swami says that you go back and forth. And that is why when Swami gives a discourse, there is a primary school kid sitting there. We were sitting there as college-going students. There were people who were 60, 70-year-olds, some people who were 90-year-olds. But Swami was speaking about the same topic to all of them. So that means that this knowledge of the ultimate can be given to you, but the process of making it your own, the Brahma Jignasa, the difference is when you really want it. That's why the word Jignasu itself means the one who does not want what is material and what is physical, but wants the ultimate knowledge. So when you come to that Jignasa state, the Brahma Jignasa will happen when you have constantly go back and forth in this process of trying to see whether you've achieved that purity and control over the mind and the senses. So coming back to the question the person was asking, as I was saying, that there is a lot of chance that such reading can give you a lot of confusion. And again, it's also an appeal to all people who read Swami's discourses and listen to Swami's discourses, let us not belittle the importance of some of these other techniques which Swami speaks about, be it bhajans or doing seva or doing meditation and all of these, because all of these eventually add up to that final understanding that we are after, right? So for this person, Sister Praveena, probably what you can do is you can explain this. This is not really a problem, but this is a sign that, you know, there is a change happening. And I started with a quote where I said, not all wanderers are lost, right? Sometimes a bit of ambiguity and a bit of confusion is probably good in spirituality because you're having an open mind. And it's a problem when you have fixed ideas. It's actually a problem when you say that, no, this is what it is, or this cannot be that. A bit of openness, not to everybody else, but a self-inquiry, an atma-vichara, as Swami would say. So in general, if there is a confusion in us, if there is a little bit of restlessness, especially from the description that you gave of this person, two things which I picked up, which you said that she believes very strongly in karma. You know, when you first read Advaita, I mean, I can say this from personal experience, when you first read about Advaita, the first concept that you will very strongly start questioning is the concept of karma. Because it seems to be just contrary to each other, but it is not. But when you first read it, it appears like that. So that is why a person who very strongly believes in karma, or very strongly believes in life, you know, flowing from one body to the other, and you having a journey like this, you will find these ideas contradictory, and you will be finding it difficult to come to terms with these two. So when such confusions come, when such issues of clarity come, I think you should tell her, first of all of these help. You know, meditation, namasmarana, that's why it really, really helps to have a guru or to have devotion to a form like Swami, because that gives a lot of confidence. You know, it's almost like a safety net under you. You are taking this journey into the open. It's a wild trek. You don't know where there's a pit, where there's a cliff, where there's an abyss. But this idea that I'm being guarded and guided by Swami gives a lot of confidence and a lot of feeling of security. But of course, if she's not a devotee of Swami, it doesn't matter. But just this idea that, you know, you are essentially divine, you don't have to really worry about anything. But all of these things, especially going out and doing seva, the act of seva has built in it enormous amounts of whatever I spoke about, sense control, mind control, titiksha, and all of this, and the idea of unity, the idea of being able to relate to another's pain, all of this is very, very important for this understanding of the higher truths of Brahma Jignasa. So probably that's one of the best suggestions I could give you, that you could pass it on to her, that to spend time in serving the people around. Because, you know, it appears like that's a physical act and this is intellectual. How will it go together? As I said, if you just go and read that Sutravahini, the first chapter of Sutravahini, Swami explains how all of this has a role to play in the higher, you know, quest which you have. So that's the answer which I thought I'll give you. I hope I answered the question, because as I said, the question itself was a little difficult to understand what the problem really was. But I'm sure that if this is not really the problem too, this is a general explanation where anybody who's reading Advaita, who's especially finding a little bit of confusion in them, like all of us, none of us are new to that. Karma and seva is a way by which you can soothe this restlessness within, and it also prepares you to understand and comprehend a little more this idea which is actually beyond the mind. So thank you for asking that question. If you have any more questions based on what I said or any clarifications on what I said, you can always write to me. And that was the question and the answer for this week, dear listeners. I actually had another beautiful incident I wanted to share with you, but I think I've taken a fair bit of time with the answer itself. And, of course, we started a bit late too, about 10 minutes late. So I'll reserve this incident which I wanted to share with you, which is a very, very beautiful incident from Swami's life. We'll keep it for another day, probably next week. But before I go, if you have a question that you'd like me to answer on this show, feel free to write to me. My mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. The mails that you send to this mail ID come directly to me. No one else reads them. So you can be assured that it'll be confidential. If you don't want to be named when I take your question, you can always mention that. I will keep your identity disclosed. I thank Sister Praveena for asking that question. I'm going to leave you with a beautiful bhajan. On the other side of it, you'll have the program by Raghu on the Ashtotram. And at 12:30, I'll be back here with Arvind for the next episode of Afternoon Satsang. But next week at 11 a.m., I'll join you again for Radio Sai Answering Booth.
कोई और न दूजा, तुम हो हमारे प्राण, दया करो हे करुणा मूर्ति, कृपा करो करो।